Farmers in the ethanol industry have been lobbying the EPA and Scott Pruitt to approve the use of gas blends with 15% ethanol for the summer.
Thank you, Scott, very much. EPA is doing really, really well. And, you know, somebody has to say that about you a little bit. You know that, Scott.
That's audio from CBS of President Trump speaking about EPA head Scott Pruitt earlier this month. Despite that, some Midwest farmers aren't so happy with either of them after plans to expand ethanol sales over the summer remain on hold. And a Chicago Tribune investigation looks at what, if any, records the state is keeping on the more than a quarter a million Illinois residents who have licenses for concealed weapons. Plus, after 2 years of trying to fix dangerously high levels of lead in its drinking fountains, the Chicago Park District may shut down half of its outdoor water fountains this summer. What do we know about the rest of the state? Stay tuned. That's coming up after the news right here on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, how safe is the drinking water from park fountains? We've got the answers from WBEZ in Chicago and our questions to park officials outside of Chicago. On tomorrow's program, we're also going to be answering your gardening questions. Are you wondering why your tomatoes won't grow? Are you struggling with rabbits? We've got some folks to help answer those questions for you. Just leave us a voicemail. Our hotline number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. But first, today we've checked in throughout the year with farmers across the state about how they're faring and feeling with the Trump administration. Mostly we've been talking about trade. Today we're discussing ethanol, President Trump, and Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA.
Thank you, Scott, very much. EPA is doing really, really well. And, you know, somebody has to say that about you a little bit. You know that, Scott. But you've done, I tell you, the EPA is doing so well, so many approvals and disapprovals. If they don't qualify, they don't qualify. But we don't have to wait 15 years to sell somebody they don't qualify. And people are really impressed with the job that's being done at the EPA. Thank you very much, Scott.
That audio from CBS. Despite the warm feelings President Trump has about Scott Pruitt, that was earlier this month, some Midwest farmers and other Hoosiers support them are specifically upset with the Environmental Protection Agency over its decisions on ethanol. In South Dakota recently, some corn producers came with them with their tractors to protest Pruitt's visit to a farm in central South Dakota when he had a private meeting with farmers. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley told the AP that President Trump had made a promise on ethanol that Pruitt is trying to break. Joining us to explain all of this is Grant Gerlach. He's with Harvest Public Media, and he's been covering Scott Pruitt's Midwest tour and speaking with farmers specifically in Nebraska, where he's based. Hey, Grant, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Yeah, good morning. Good to be here.
Grant, can you explain a little bit, first of all, about ethanol, what agriculture was expecting from the Trump administration this summer with ethanol?
Oh, well, Donald Trump was a very vocal supporter of ethanol during the campaign, and they expected the Trump administration to be very strong in favor of ethanol when it came to its policies. And a lot of the things that farm groups and ethanol companies have been looking for just haven't come true yet. And instead, there's been a lot of this back and forth negotiation in the White House, lobbying back and forth between ethanol companies and oil companies. And at times, from one day to the next, it was hard to tell who was having the upper hand. One day it would seem like oil companies were getting their way. Then the next day it would seem like ethanol companies are getting their way. So there's just been this off and on relationship when it comes to ethanol policy between the Trump administration and farm groups and ethanol groups.
And what does the EPA have to do with supporting ethanol? How do they come into this?
The EPA determines policy around the ethanol mandate, the federal ethanol mandate, through a law that includes the renewable fuel standard. And once a year, they come out with numbers that set a quota, more or less, for the amount of ethanol that's blended into the gasoline supply. So when you fuel up your car and it says E10 on there, that's gasoline with a 10% blend of ethanol, E85, 85% blend. And they've been talking a lot this year about E15, a 15% blend of ethanol that has been approved for sale for years now, but at the same time has been restricted during the summer months. And so over the summer, in a lot of places, E15 goes away. And farm groups and ethanol groups would like to see it sold year-round, just like these other kinds of ethanol, because they see that as a way to move more ethanol through the system and, by virtue of that, more corn through the system.
Why has E15 not been sold in the summer traditionally, Grant?
Well, there's this policy that has to do with air quality. The fuels that produce emissions that cause ozone and air quality problems, especially in urban areas. And E15 actually is no worse than other kinds of fuel when it comes to those emissions. It's actually better than E10, I'm pretty sure. But there's just kind of this quirk in the policy that E15 doesn't have the policy waiver that E10 has. So while E10 is allowed to be sold year-round, even with these air quality potential issues, E15 is not. So they're really just looking for the same waiver that other kinds of fuel have to be sold over the summer. E15 just doesn't have that.
So if E15 is the type of ethanol we're talking about, can you remind us again what role corn plays in ethanol production?
Corn is the main source for ethanol, so the starch in the corn kernel is converted to the ethanol, the alcohol that is in ethanol fuel. And, you know, driving up and down the roads in Illinois or Iowa or Nebraska, you see these ethanol plants on the side of the road with huge clouds of steam coming out the top. Farmers sell a lot of their corn to these ethanol plants where that corn is converted to fuel, and then there's a byproduct that's used in animal feed. So it's become a really integral part of the corn production system in the middle of the country, with ethanol being an important industry to consume the corn that's being produced here.
We're speaking with Harvest Public Media reporter Grant Gerlach. Grant, thanks for explaining a little bit about the background of ethanol to us and what was promised originally to farmers and to other ethanol producers, or the idea of what had been discussed with these folks prior to this summer. That brings us to EPA head Scott Pruitt's Midwest tour. How has that been going?
Well, it was a little rocky in places. He came to Lincoln, Nebraska, and it was a polite meeting, maybe because Nebraska's governor was in the room, and I don't think the farm groups there wanted to embarrass the governor, but you could definitely sense some of the frustration in the room. And talking to a couple farmers afterwards, they wanted, while he was there, they wanted Scott Pruitt to basically commit to a timeline, to say, you know, we're going to get E15 approved for year-round sale. We're going to get that done this year, or we're going to get it done in the fall or early next year. But he really wouldn't commit to that. What he said was that he's been told to put that proposal on pause, and presumably by the White House, and that he's waiting to be told to put it back in motion. And that was frustrating for farmers to hear, because they've been waiting for this, and you know, they're hearing that it's ready to go, and you know, they're not sure exactly what they're waiting for. And what they're really waiting for is to try to work out some issues that oil companies have been raising and that the White House has been sympathetic to, when it comes to the cost to oil companies to carry out these ethanol policies. And so E15 has been one of these bargaining chips between oil companies and the ethanol companies and the EPA and the White House, all these different players in the room, trying to trade back and forth between allowing E15 year-round and then giving some concessions that would lower the cost for these oil companies when it comes to meeting the ethanol regulations.
So, Grant, it sounds like this particular blend of ethanol has been used a bit as a bargaining chip between the traditional oil companies and then folks who are trying to get this other non-fossil fuel-based fuel source out there. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, and it gets into the weeds really fast, but there's this system behind the ethanol mandate where oil refiners prove that they've been meeting the letter of that rule. They have to turn in these credits. And if they don't have those credits by using ethanol themselves, then they have to buy them on a market for these credits. And when there's less ethanol being used, or, well, the price of these credits goes up and down. It's been higher than usual lately, and they want some policies to be changed that would end up lowering the price of these credits and lowering the cost that they have to pay to carry out these ethanol rules, is what it comes down to for the oil companies. They're trying to lower their cost for getting ethanol into the market.
We've been speaking with Harvest Public Media reporter Grant Gerlach about this issue of ethanol and farmers. I wanted to bring an Illinois farm voice into this conversation. Len Corzine is a fifth-generation family farmer from Assumption, Illinois, just south of Decatur, also former president of the National Corn Growers Association. Len, thanks for taking the time to join us. I know this is a busy time of year for you.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on to discuss this very important issue to us out here on the farm.
Len, can you explain to all of us how much corn grown in Illinois ends up as ethanol? How important is that?
Ethanol is the biggest market for corn, especially in central Illinois. We do have the river system, and an export market is important as well. But ethanol is the market. Ethanol, when we passed the energy bill, got us out of the rut that we didn't have anywhere to go with the production efficiencies we were seeing. And ethanol has become the market maker for us.
And so what kind of effect does it have on, I want to start with just corn farmers in general across Illinois, and then ask you about your farm specifically. What kind of effect does it have when this expansion of summer ethanol sales remains on hold, or when you don't know when it's going to happen?
It affects the number of gallons of ethanol being used, and with that, it backs right into the price given to us on the farm. And it's really magnified with some other market conditions that are going on this year. It's not a huge amount of gallons, but it is an increase, and that's what we need, is an increase in the market, and very easily doable. We've got the gallons of ethanol, we've got the bushels of corn, and it gives the consumer choice of the E15, and it is just a technical factor that actually Grant explained very well. Should be done, and it has been stalled and too important to use as a pawn.
I wanted to ask you about that, how you think as a farmer personally you feel about it. Sort of seems like you and other folks who are farming corn for ethanol, do you feel like you've kind of been caught up in a bigger debate over some things here?
Well, we have. The whole idea that the petroleum industry, who is at the end of the day, the blenders, the refiners make money on ethanol, but it does take a little bit away from their market share. Ethanol is the most environmentally friendly and cheapest octane enhancer, which is a very important component of gasoline, especially in the newer vehicles as they're getting more efficient. And so it is something that we should not use the oil industry as this pawn. The oil industry has said, well, we need an offset, something to help us. And Secretary Pruitt has already given offsets. This it's called the RIN, the Renewable Identification Number, that was alluded to by Grant. He has granted waivers from what has been required under the law. And he has granted waivers that amount to 1.6 gallons of ethanol, which is 10% of the over 10% of the ethanol market. So a big number. So the offset to the petroleum people is already there, and we're waiting for something from our side, which I think the Trump administration continues to say, President Trump, he supports ethanol, but Secretary Pruitt is not.
What would you like to see Secretary Pruitt do?
I think he needs to move forward and quit stalling. This summer waiver on the RVP, this that helps us sell E15 in the summertime, gets rid of confusion for all of the suppliers of gasoline to our consumers around the country, and he can do it immediately, and he should. And he is stalling and continues to stall, and so, in my eyes, he's not doing his job.
We're speaking with Len Corzine, a corn farmer just south of Decatur. He farms in Christian County. His family has your family's been farming for six generations, right, Len? Because your son is farming as well as the sixth generation. You're the fifth generation.
You're exactly right. I'm the fifth generation on our farm, and son Craig is the sixth.
And when we're thinking about this issue, is this something where you felt like you thought this was, I wonder, what timing you thought was going to happen with the Trump administration? Was this something that you thought that this would be implemented faster than it has been?
Yes, actually, this has been talked about for quite some time. You could go clear back to the first of the year, and needed to be the decision made and implemented then to get it in so everyone could prepare and have the E15 in place for the summer sales, which did not happen. So we are already 6 months late, and there's talk now that they will do it in the fall, which actually would probably be okay now as long as they will. The summertime, to get it in place for summertime, we're already into summer, and so we really are too late for the summer of 2018.
And is part of this also just the stability of this? You alluded to other issues with the market, and I think we've heard this concern not just from farmers but from the business community just about the questions of stability and knowing what's next and whether we're talking about trade or, in this case, ethanol. Is that a bigger part of the picture here as well, that it's just not knowing what will happen?
You're exactly right. Whenever you create uncertainty, and in this case in ethanol, you affect the market in a negative way. So everyone from the farmers to the ethanol producers to the folks that blend the gasoline to the folks that provide the gasoline at the pumps that we all fill up at, they need to know. If they don't have it's all uncertain, what do they do? So everybody kind of sits on their hands or goes hand to mouth, if you will. You can't plan for the future in every business in the whole supply chain of fuels for our vehicles needs to know. So everybody really is affected by this.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll just wrap up this conversation with Lynn Corusine, Illinois corn farmer Grant Gerlach with Harvest Public Media in Nebraska about ethanol. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be answering your gardening questions, whether that's about tomatoes or rabbits or begonias. You can give us a call. Our voicemail is 217-300-2121. Leave us a voicemail. We'll answer that tomorrow. Right now, we're talking ethanol with Lynn Corusine. He and his family have farmed for six generations just south of Decatur in Assumption, Illinois. He's also the former president of the National Corn Growers Association. Lynn, just to pick up that point you were making about the uncertainty, I just wondered if when we're thinking about uncertainty, whether it's about trade or now with ethanol or other things, if that's what you think has led to protests with some farmers across the Midwest, because I have to think it's a little unexpected sight to think that farmers, and certainly there's been a lot of conversation about agriculture and support for the Trump administration now being a little unhappy, clearly, with at least Administrator Scott Pruitt over this ethanol issue. Do you think it's a little unusual, these protests, or maybe a sign of frustration?
I think it's a sign of frustration with what has happened in the marketplace. And just to give you a quick overview, with the drop in corn prices, 50 cents, $1.50 or more drop in soybean prices over the past 2 weeks, that means $100 an acre that is lost, or that we don't have, that we've been counting on as far as in the marketplace. So everything around this E15 issue gets magnified, or every segment gets magnified. I mentioned uncertainty before, and whether it's uncertainty in the ethanol arena or in the trade arena or even in the farm bill arena with how we use risk management and our safety net, it has created a lot of frustration out on the farm. And I think maybe I applaud Secretary Pruitt for making his pass through the countryside, but farmers are generally friendly, polite people, but I think we're maybe too polite to him when he was here. He needed to be made felt more uncomfortable to let him know really what these issues mean and what we expect to have happened. We are out here in rural America, and that's what helped elect President Trump. We all know that because we were tired of others treating rural America, the heartland, as a flyover zone.
So at least, as you're saying, to his point, he's there. You would like him to take action. Grant Garlock is also with us from Harvest Public Media. Grant, I just wanted to end by bringing up a point that Len brought up, which is the farm bill. Can you just update us on where we're at with farm bill negotiations?
Well, the farm bill has some movement. It passed last week in the House. It's being debated in the Senate this week, could pass the Senate this week. If the Senate passes the bill, there's still a lot of work to be done. At that point, it would go to a conference committee between the two chambers, and they have a lot to talk about, especially when it comes to the SNAP program, the federal food stamp program. The House would make some big changes to SNAP when it comes to the work requirements for some people in that program. Democrats have really stood up against that, and so that those changes that are in the House did not show up in the Senate. And they'll have to talk that over and figure out how they can write a bill that will satisfy those conservative members in the House that want to see changes to SNAP and those Democrats in the Senate who really won't go for that.
And Len, while I have you here, I just wonder your final thoughts on the farm bill. What is most important to you in that?
What's most important is the risk management arena, which is around crop insurance. It's important that we have the SNAP program in the farm bill because we need something so our urban neighbors can have skin in the game, if you will, or things that are important to them. And it is around food and nutrition, so it really belongs in the farm bill. But it for us out on the farm, the real issue is risk management and crop insurance, especially in these times with what we've seen in the drop in prices and the uncertainty we've already talked about. We need risk management, and the program has worked very well. We've moved away from direct payments and those kind of things and actually saved the federal coffers a lot of money in doing that. And so we need to continue that part in this farm bill. And once again, it needs to be done. The frustrating thing for me, if I may, is everyone knows when we pass a farm bill that it's when it expires. And every time in Washington, D.C., they wait until the last minute, and then we get extensions, and there's a big push at the end. And it's the way it works, but it's very frustrating to us out here on the farm.
Frustrating, and also affects your business, Len.
That's exactly right. And those uncertainty things we had talked about, all of that together really puts strife in the farm and frustration to all of us out here. And that's why you see the demonstrations. And we need to take those frustrations to our representatives and say, hey, hopefully the folks belong to the farm groups are really the best way to collectively take those thoughts forward to Washington, D.C., as well as Springfield, Illinois, if I may, to let those folks know what is important to us and speak with a strong voice.
That's Len Corzine. His family's been farming in Assumption, that's just south of Decatur, for six generations. I want to thank you, Len. I know this is a busy time of year for you with corn, so thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. I also want to thank Grant Garlock. He's a reporter with Harvest Public Media. By the way, NET News in Nebraska has a podcast that Grant does on the farm bill. It's called On the Table, if you're more interested in details on that. Grant, Len, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Each year, thousands of Illinois residents attend concealed carry classes and apply for licenses. In Illinois, about 2% of the adult population, just over 250,000 people, have concealed carry weapon licenses. Since Illinois became the last state to allow these such licenses 4 years ago, it's been estimated there have been about 40 shootings by people who have a concealed carry license. That's not a number the Illinois State Police has been keeping track of, so it's hard to say exactly how many shootings there have been. Why is almost nothing known about the dozens of these concealed carry shootings that have happened across Illinois? Who's keeping track of this data? Those are the questions posed by Chicago Tribune reporter Catherine Rosenberg Douglas. She's behind a recent investigation into these shootings. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for being with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So as I just mentioned, so there's about 265,000 people in Illinois who have concealed carry licenses. I wanted to start first with what kind of training is required for a CCL license?
Sure. If you are an average citizen going out to get your concealed carry license for the first time, first you'll need your FOID card. That's its own process. And then you're able to sign up for classes. That would take 16 hours. Typically, it's done over a weekend, so people will have you sign up for a Saturday-Sunday class, and you do 8 hours each day, and eight of those hours focus on technique, and eight of those hours focus on law. The instructors vary. Essentially, you just need your own concealed carry license to go on and become a concealed carry instructor, and they can create their own curriculum. So certainly, different people are, you know, teach the class differently. And then if you are a licensed law enforcement officer in the state, you only need an 8-hour class.
Okay. And what are the numbers look like in terms of how many people are carrying these licenses recently? I mentioned Illinois became the last state to allow this 4 years ago.
Right. There's about 75,000 people just in Cook County that have a concealed carry license. And as you mentioned, about 265,000 in the state.
And that brings us to when there is a shooting incident that involves someone with a concealed carry license. How does that work? I imagine whenever there's a shooting, there's an investigation, right?
Definitely. It's like any other incident. The piece of paper that you have, that license that you have, doesn't change anything at all. So if you discharge your weapon, you should notify law enforcement and they should come out. So some of the cases that we tracked are as simple as that. Someone accidentally discharged their weapon or intentionally discharged their weapon. But, you know, the focus is on being a law-abiding citizen, and you don't just let that happen without contacting law enforcement. Certainly if someone is hit and there's an ambulance is called and all of that, the police will do an investigation. What we were really interested in finding out is what happens after the police do that investigation. There is actually an insurance company that specifically insures concealed carry holders. And they will say, you know, as soon as a shooting has happened, call us and we'll stay on the phone with you and make sure you know what to say to police and things like that. So, the investigations can vary depending, on the same factors as they would anytime, but it's what, once the police have the case, we've seen, a handful of cases where that person who is just shot, in some cases fatally killed someone, they're let go within 30 minutes. They're sent home. It's a phone call to the state's attorney's office asking, whether they want charges filed, and if everyone believes that it's, if everyone believes that it was in self-defense or that they were in fear for their life or the life of someone else, that they acted, within the law, then they're free to go. And there's really no follow-up. So it's not a case where, obviously if the police don't think that anything, was done incorrectly or illegally, certainly then that's fine. They should be free to go home. But there's no follow-up in terms of whether, anyone ever reaches out to them or whether this even goes on their concealed carry file. So the state police have made it very clear that they will not learn that a shooting has taken place unless charges are filed. So all of these cases where it is clearly self-defense, they acted to protect their own life, there's not even a mention in these people's files that they shot someone. There's certainly, nothing like, should we offer this person additional training on specific parts of the law? Should we offer this person counseling? One of the articles we wrote as a sidebar to this main project was, I sat down with a Chicago police officer who was shot on duty and turned around and returned fire. And, his main point is that if you have to kill someone, it doesn't matter whether, you know, the law tells you it's okay. It's going to be difficult to sleep at night. It's going to be difficult to deal with all of the emotions that come along with that. And so he's part of a survivors group where they, you know, they deal with that, and he goes to therapy for that. So none of these things are offered to a civilian. So someone who's trained less than a police officer, they just sort of send you home, and there's nothing else.
And Catherine, how often is this happening where there have been incidents, as you said, the Tribune, you guys, how did you find out this information of also how often this is happening?
So I am a reporter on the breaking news desk, and we basically 24 hours a day, we track all of the shootings in the city of Chicago. That's one of our functions. And as I, you know, would sit there on my shifts and listen to the police scanner, it seemed like a noticeable difference from the previous year, how frequently we were hearing, you know, the person has a CCL, has a license. So it just started to, you know, wow, it seems like it's happening more and more. And that is what we found. What we did to find this data, because again, no state agency is tracking this information at all. They don't communicate with one another at all. We were kind of forced to rely on news reports, our own, and of course, other agencies throughout the state. There is no law that says that a local police agency must, you know, must release that information to the media. So we think that our numbers are conservative, actually, that there are possibly several more because they were never reported to a media outlet. But we combed through 4 years, you know, this became legal on January 1st of 2014. So through today, we've been keeping track of which ones we're able to find. And just a variety of pulling public information records, FOIAs, and court records, things like that, to find out how many there have been.
You mentioned ISP, the Illinois State Police. We did invite them to join our program today. They declined our invitation. We also asked them if they'd like us to read a statement on there, and they didn't respond. What did the state police say to you, Catherine, about whether or not they think this information needs to be tracked, those sorts of things?
You know, they really wouldn't get into the sort of whether questions, should you or should you not. And what they really rely on is the law that was, you know, kind of hastily put together in the end of 2013. As I'm sure you know, this was court mandated that we needed to have this program. And so legislators in the end of 2013 tried to get this ready for the beginning of 2014. And, you know, one of the things they decided not to require fingerprints in this law. I've spoken with some of those legislators, you know, in retrospect saying, oh, maybe we should have done that. So there are a lot of things, you know, they were doing this quickly. And what the Illinois State Police will tell you is what the law states, that they are not required. And it actually says they are not allowed to release information about who the concealed carry holders are and when they get into incidents and things like that. So for them, they feel, you know, that's not our job. And we actually had one of the people we spoke with for this said, that is not our function. We issue licenses when no one objects. We do background checks. We hand people their permits, but we don't have oversight of this while it's going on, sort of. It's when they come to renew, or, you know, if at any point they become ineligible or they have a prohibitor, like they have more than two DUIs or things like that, then they revoke the licenses. But they just feel that's not their purview. It's not their job. And it really seems like it doesn't fall to anyone. Everyone has their own small piece of it. As you mentioned earlier, obviously the police go out and they investigate. If the police don't think anything illegal happened, you know, certainly it shouldn't necessarily escalate to, you know, obviously to the state's attorney's office or anything like that. But what we're wondering is, why isn't there just communication to say, you know, this person was in this situation, what can we do to help this person? And what, you know, what tools can we give them to make sure they're as safe as they can be?
We have to take a break. Catherine, if you have a minute to stick around, there's a couple more questions I just wanted to ask you as we finish up this conversation with Catherine Rosenberg Douglas with the Chicago Tribune. Behind one of the folks behind a Chicago Tribune investigation into concealed carry shootings. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Catherine Rosenberg Douglas, a Chicago Tribune reporter, one of the folks behind an investigation into concealed carry shootings across Illinois. The Tribune found that there had been nearly 40 shootings by people with a concealed carry law license. There's more than 250,000 people in Illinois who have them. I want to play some audio here. It's actually from some folks that Catherine talked to. It's David Lombardo. He's a concealed carry instructor.
Since I started this school, I've trained over 7,000 students, and I've done probably 1,200 concealed carry, Illinois concealed carry, and I don't even know how many Utah and Florida, because they were easy to do. Overwhelmingly, they are very conservative, very law-abiding people.
That's the voice of David Lombardo, who's featured in a video from the Chicago Tribune as part of their reporting on concealed carry shootings in Illinois. We're speaking with Tribune reporter Catherine Rosenberg Douglas about her reporting. Catherine, is David's response similar to others who train these thousands of people for CCL licenses, saying they're safe, they're not usually involved in the shootings? Is that a common sentiment?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think almost every concealed carry instructor that I spoke with, sort of said the same thing. And you know, they're not wrong. They're not wrong. It takes a lot of money to do this. It takes a lot of time and effort to do this. And so just from those basic standpoints, I mean, you think that when you devote your time and you spend your money on something, you know, you want to follow the letter of the law. You want to be, as conservative as possible to make sure that you don't put yourself in harm's way. And they are, on the whole, a very responsible conservative group. And I think that's great. I think where the question came in for us, though, was, shouldn't we make sure? You know, there's so much of this idea, anecdotally speaking, well, I'm sure they're only protecting people. I'm sure they're only, but how do you know? And so, of course, as journalists, that was, you know, what we kind of set out to find is, what do the facts suggest? You know, you have this feeling about this for the reasons that he mentioned, I just mentioned, but shouldn't you be able to point to fact? And so that's what we set out to do.
That's Catherine Rosenberg Douglas. We will tweet out those stories if you want to read the package of reporting that the Chicago Tribune did on this issue. Catherine, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
If you're like me, you try to do your part for the environment by not using plastic water bottles. But if you're out running or at the beach, that means using water fountains. That's especially true for kids at camp all summer. But what do we know about how safe that water is? Actually, not a lot. WBEZ Chicago reporter Monica Ng started to look into this a couple years ago as part of their regular series, Curious City. And through that, she discovered dangerously high levels of leads in park fountains. The result of that is that the Chicago Park District may be turning off nearly half of its fountains, almost 1,200 of them, due to unsafe levels of poisonous lead. To talk to us more about her investigation and help us understand the answers we got when we posed this question to other park districts outside of Chicago, Monica's on the phone with me now from WBEZ. Hi, Monica. Welcome back. It's always nice to have you here.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
Monica, why did you first start looking into the water fountains and the water quality in Chicago?
Well, in the wake of the crisis in Flint, I started looking at Chicago's home water, and then I started asking, hey, have you guys ever checked the water in Chicago public schools? I got a lot of pushback where the CEO of CPS said, you know what, we don't need to, stop bugging me, and I kept pushing and pushing and foying, and finally they said, yeah, out of an abundance of caution, that's the exact words they used, we will check a certain amount of vulnerable schools. What they found was that there actually were a lot of problems. So then they checked all the schools, and they found some really alarming levels of lead in the water at Chicago Public Schools. Then I started working for our Curious City show, where we answer questions from the public, and a whole bunch of people wanted to know, why are they running the water fountains, or, well, has anyone ever checked Park District water fountains? I FOIA'd that information, and basically they had no records of ever checking. They checked. They found about one-fourth had levels higher than the EPA 15 parts per billion, which is not a safety level. That's simply what they thought that municipalities could achieve. five parts per billion is what you can have in bottled water. And so they found quite a lot. So then the next year they started flushing, and people said, well, why am I seeing all the fountains running constantly in Chicago when they have buttons for on and off? And they tried to flush some of the lead from the fountains after they hadn't been used all winter. And then this year, they came up with a plan to go to shut down half of them until they can address the situation.
And is that flushing an effective remedy for water safety, Monica?
Well, what they found was of the fountains that had really high levels of lead, about 75% were remedied through that 1 month of flushing at the beginning of the season, and they could be put back on push-button use. About more than 100 of them, if you put them back on push-button use, they would still be delivering high levels of lead. So those are the ones that were on constantly for several months of the summer. So it did work with some. And then this year, they're deciding, okay, do we want to keep all of those on all summer, or do we just want to do that with ones that are in high traffic areas where people really need the water? And they're still assessing that and deciding which ones to leave on all summer.
That's in Chicago. Monica, can I ask, can you remind us, you mentioned parts per, there's sort of an allowable amount of lead that's allowed in the water. What part, and I imagine some of this is perhaps inevitable, how much is dangerous?
Well, all the health authorities across the world say no level of lead is safe. What municipalities and what federal legislation have done is try to see, okay, what can we possibly achieve? Maybe we can achieve less than 15 parts per billion and fewer than 10% of the homes we check. And for bottled water, again, the level is no more than 5 parts per billion. So you don't want any lead in your water, but for bottled water, for instance, no more than 5 parts per billion.
And who is in charge of checking all of this?
That's a really good question. It seems like there's not a great, at least not a clear plan for, let's say, who's in charge of checking schools, who's in charge of checking parks, because, again, when I FOIA that information, they couldn't come up with any tests that they had done to see that this water is safe. Now they're doing it. Now they say that they're going to remediate. But in terms of homes, there's something called the lead and copper rule, and that requires municipalities to test a certain number of sample homes. And if 10% of them have levels higher than 15 parts per billion, then they have to come up with some sort of remediation plan. The problem is in Chicago, it's been pointed out by journalists and different researchers that we check about 50 homes, and they're all in the same area, often city workers, and the actual methodology has been questioned. One scientist actually at the EPA has said we really need to do what are called sequential samples, where we, let's say, look at 20 liters straight from the morning tap to, 20 liters out to see where that lead may be coming in. When you just say check the first sample and then maybe 5 liters down and then 10 liters down, what he found is you miss a lot of lead that you would have found if you had been doing more thorough and comprehensive testing. So he believes that just because Chicago has come in under 10% of those homes, it doesn't mean that there's not a problem.
So that's when testing happening, and that's homes. I wanted to ask you again about the rest of the state in parks. The executive director of the Illinois Environmental Council was not aware of any testing done by parks anywhere in the state other than Chicago. Does that surprise you?
Well, no, it surprised me that Chicago had never tested, but now that I know that really there was no one who was forcing them to be checking schools and parks, it doesn't surprise me that the rest of the state hasn't. I did hear about some tests they were doing in Evanston, but as far as it being required, it all seems very voluntary. Now, Heather Staines had presented, I want to say, Senate Bill 2030, and that would require every municipality to come up with a plan over the next 10 years to deal with the lead in its water. That went nowhere. It ended up in rules, I believe, in a committee that is simply going to go nowhere. But, I think a lot of the people pushing for better checking, they feel like it's going to take some time to get people on board.
We're speaking with WBEZ Chicago reporter Monica Ng about her reporting into lead in the drinking water in park fountains across Chicago. The result of that is the Chicago Park District may be turning off nearly half of its fountains, almost 1,200 fountains in the city, due to unsafe levels of poisonous lead. We actually reached out to a few park districts across the state to ask them if they test. We did not receive any comment from the city of Bloomington or Rockford about whether or not they tested water quality. We did get a response from Champaign. The park district director, Joe DeLuce, told us that they work with Illinois American Water, who has outstanding water, quote, so we rely on them to provide good, safe water to our parks. And when we asked if they knew if Illinois American did lead testing, the park district told us that would be a question for them. We did ask them, Monica, we did ask Illinois American Water if they tested, and they said no one's ever asked. They said it's never come up. So is this kind of a typical back and forth that we hear when the park district says, well, we get the water from this place and the water company says this? And is this a typical
thing?
There's
a lot of finger pointing that goes around. And I think it should be made clear how these things work. A lot of these water filtration systems and American water testing, they ensure that the source water, that the water going into those pipes is clean and free of contaminants to the extent that they can. When it makes its journey to your home or to that park water fountain, that is a whole other story. It can be going through lead service lines. It can be going through pipes that have had lead solder. It can be going through fixtures that have brass and lead in them. All of these things will affect the quality of your water. And so it can be clean as can be, as, you know, as by all accounts it is in Chicago, but the journey is where things can change.
And then when we think about other oversight, the Illinois Department of Public Health told us, as you mentioned, there's no statutes or regulations specifically for freestanding public drinking fountains. They told us that the responsibility for safe water lies with the owner of the property upon which the fountain sits. So I imagine that then leaves us to the park district or the village or the city or the state, right? I wonder what you recommend to people who are listening to this, maybe getting a little discouraged about thinking or getting nervous about drinking water from a drinking fountain at a park.
Well, I would do kind of what I did, which was bug them. Say, hey, have you ever checked? Hey, have you ever checked? And if they don't want to answer it, FOIA that information. Citizens can do that and say, hey, can you show me any documents that indicate you have ever checked whether or not this fountain has excessive levels of lead? Because my kids are drinking out of it, or kids in our community are drinking out of it. And then that can often get them to check. I mean, a lot of people don't want to look at this issue because, frankly, it can be a very expensive issue to replace the lead service lines.
And Monica, right, this is actually surfacing in the Chicago mayoral race. This is becoming an issue. People have been talking about it.
Yes, as we speak, Paul Vallis, who was former head of Chicago Public Schools, who has come back to Chicago to challenge Mayor Rahm Emanuel in the mayoral race, is having a press conference right now at the University Club announcing his plan for what he would do to remediate Chicago's water to get the lead out. I think it's going to become a big issue in the mayoral race because this is probably a bigger issue in Chicago than it is in any other city across the nation.
This WBEZ Chicago's Monica Ng. Monica, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Tomorrow, we're going to be answering your gardening questions. We're going to take any questions that you have. Are you tired of rabbits that are eating everything? Do you need advice about your vegetables or flowers or plants or trees? Leave us a voicemail. Our hotline number is 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. We'll do our best to answer that during tomorrow's program. By the way, if you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple to download. You set your home station, and if you search for the 21st to follow us, that's another way to easily listen to past programs. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. all those links, how to find us on Facebook as well. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. See you back here tomorrow.